This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic emphasizing internal medicine, including special programs for mental health issues such as depression or anxiety. The Way of Health is located at the corner of Southeast Market at 106th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-788-4165.
To be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Downtown Neighborhood Association rejects TriMet's plans to overhaul Portland's bus mall this week. And thousands of Oregon children may have to be revaccinated following a new report study.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,280 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,119 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, February 22, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Kirk Vanderveer. The Walmart Corporation won two important site fights yesterday. The Cornelius City Council voted 3-1 last night to rezone almost 3 acres previously set aside for residential development for a 204,000-square-foot supercenter. Walmart still has a few remaining procedural hurdles before it can move forward. The activist group Cornelius First has organized against the development for months, and dozens of people attended a recent meeting. In Medford yesterday, Walmart won tentative approval for a new supercenter along Interstate 5. The decision came after 2 years of hearings with the Medford Site Plan and Architectural Commission, City Council, and State Land Use Board of Appeals. The Site Plan Commission continued the hearing on a traffic study until March 3rd. The City of Medford could give the final okay to the project at that meeting. Construction could begin as soon as late spring.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on an Oregon case concerning capital murder. Justices said today that defendants in capital murder cases do not have a constitutional right to use alibi evidence when they are sentenced by juries. The ruling was 8-0. Randy Lee Guzek was convicted by an Oregon jury for the June 1987 murders of Rod and Lois Hauser, the uncle and aunt of his former high school girlfriend. The murder convictions were upheld by the state's highest court, but changes in Oregon's law and mistakes by the trial judge led the Oregon Supreme Court to overturn his death sentence 3 times. The case returns to Oregon, where Guzek will have another sentencing trial. The case is Oregon v. Guzek, 04928. On Monday, Portland's Downtown Neighborhood Association voted Monday to oppose TriMet's downtown mall revitalization project, and it is presently designed. KABU's Richard Francis has an update.
The vote ended what has been a 4-month-long analysis of the project by the association and its board of directors. Monday's meeting began with the taking of final testimony addressing the mall design, provided largely by present and former TriMet Citizens Advisory Council members speaking in favor of the mall design. DNA also received a report from its present CAC representative, Jennifer Geske, concerning TriMet's responses to DNA's most recent questions. Then, citing safety, convenience, economic, and aesthetic concerns with the mall design and construction plans, the DNA board voted 4-3, opposing the mall design in its present form. Of her board's decision, President Renee Feldman said,
"There has been in the material that we've received from TriMet a lack of clear, complete, and consistent information. What were they asked to do? One thing only, explore the serpentine alignment, which they called, quote, not recommended, unquote. But TriMet had already decided that they were going with that weaving serpentine alignment, period. So how do they make the best of it? They didn't compare with other alternatives. For your listeners, I encourage them to go to the TriMet website and look at the video. And as they're watching the buses and TriMet weave in and out, and as they see the bus going behind TriMet, ask them what happens if Max breaks down, or what happens if the bus breaks down.
You also, as I recall, had a member raising issues about the separation of bus stops.
Yes. That is something that's come up over and over again. It's our understanding that bus stops are going to be twice as far apart.
One of the issues raised by the association's board was the lack of real citizen involvement in the process, and a process in which no one is answerable or accountable for decisions made.
The Downtown Neighborhood Association, without exception, is a strong supporter of mass transit. Without answers, we're concerned about the project going forward. Most people don't know how they can actually voice that concern, or aren't even aware of what's going on. You know, I would say it isn't that there hasn't been real citizen involvement, because real citizens who are concerned have been involved with the process. It appears that throughout the entire process, this, quote, citizen participation has all been done by special interest groups.
Many of the issues raised by DNA board members echoed issues raised by another group, Riverfront for People, who addressed mall design problems at DNA's February 14th meeting. A recording of that presentation is available on KBOO's website in the news archive section at kboo.org. DNA's rejection of the plan is the first severe bump in the road that the lengthy approval process has suffered. It occurs less than 1 month before TriMet is supposed to submit its final design to the Federal Transit Administration for approval. The deadline for that is March 15th of this year. Any further action on the mall plan is now in the court of Sam Adams and the City Council, plus Mayor Tom Potter's office and any other citizens and neighborhood groups who feel like reconsidering the plan now that more information about the implications of the mall design has become readily available to the general public. For KBOO News, I'm Richard Francis.
After spending years working with families in North and Northeast Portland, the International Center for Traditional Childbearing is branching out to the African continent. Here with us in Studio 2 is the organization's director, Shafia Monroe, to talk about the organization's new project. Ms. Monroe, thanks for coming down to KBOO.
Thanks for having me. This is very exciting for us as an organization. I have to think back quickly when I gave the organization the name. I was very specific to give it International Center for Traditional Childbearing, hoping for this moment. So we did receive an email from across the country asking us to bring midwives from America to Sierra Leone to work with the women who have been victims of the Civil War and do some work with training the midwives. We'll be leaving June 11th to the 24th, 2006.
Excellent, excellent. What does your group do locally, and how did you get started?
Well, we began in 1991. We're an infant mortality prevention, pregnancy support, midwife training organization. Our goal is to keep our country aware that there's a high death rate of black babies in America, including Oregon, always has been. And so we do education and provide services for low-income, uninsured women, but also, more importantly, in terms of response, we train women to actually be midwives to help make a difference.
And what kind of unique issues are faced by black midwives and the local families you work with?
Well, the fact that the numbers are so small in the state is a challenge right there, getting the word out, which is why I'm so glad that KBOO is so with it to invite us on the show today, that there is a need to increase the number of health care providers in general, but particularly women who want to work with pregnant women. Obstetricians are pulling back because of malpractice issues. They're not accepting people who are on Oregon Health Plan. Women are being moved from comfortable areas to non-comfortable areas. So having midwives who are community-based, who understand the cultural challenges, are really essential. We're going to see babies make it, you know, through pregnancy to having quality of life, but also having the family in general being able to advocate for themselves and be, you know, happy American citizens and visitors as well.
And now your group's traveling to Sierra Leone. Can you talk about that project and why it's important?
Well, it's interesting that some of the disparities are very similar in America for African Americans as is for different countries in Africa as well. Sierra Leone's a little bit extreme because they had the Civil War, but the infant mortality is 104 per thousand, meaning that 104 babies die out of 1,000 for African Americans between 16 to 22, depending what part of the country you live in. So I think the common ground is able to train community-based people who can make a difference, understanding what the health issues are and how to deal with it by being midwives. Our event is going to be March 4th. We have the international representative of Sally Young coming into Portland. We're very honored. She's coming in from New York with her husband to do a training for anyone who's interested in learning what are the issues in Sierra Leone, how they can get involved either by going or helping to develop what we call midwife kits, getting supplies that the midwives can use in their country right now.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Monroe. That was Shafia Monroe, director of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing in Portland. For more information, go to www.blackmidwives.org or call 503-460-9324.
George W. insists that he has supreme power as commander-in-chief to spy on American citizens without following any stinking due process of law. Dick Cheney snarls that anyone who disagrees is a terrorist coddler. Karl Rove snaps that Democrats who oppose Bush's spy operation are Osama lovers. Alberto Sino Evil Gonzalez told Congress that the president can by damn make his own rules in wartime. Wow, these guys are like hormone-addled 14-year-olds. They're doing a high strut in hopes of intimidating their political enemies. But wait, while the puffed-up Bushites are looking to their left, look who's coming at them from the right. Bush's unilateral assertion of autocratic executive power is hardly a conservative principle, and a growing number of prominent right-wingers are howling that Bush and gang are desecrating their movement. My criteria for judging this stuff is what would a President Hillary do with these same powers, says Paul Wyrick, the influential head of a right-wing think tank. And here comes Grover Norquist, a Newt Gingrichite who hates big government. There is no excuse for violating the rule of law. Not to get warrants before spying appears to be an expression of contempt, he says. David Keene, head of the American Conservative Union, is even more blunt. Their argument is extremely dangerous in the long term because it can be used to justify all kinds of things that I'm sure the president nor the attorney general has thought about. The American system was set up on the assumption that you can't rely on the goodwill of people with power. Also, Bruce Fine, a top legal official with Ronald Reagan, chimes in that it's Bush's defenders who are embracing the most liberal and utopian view of human nature with their trust me argument, a view that would cause the founding fathers to weep. This is Jim Hightower saying, on this one, mark me down as siding with the conservatives. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Independent Native News following our newscast, then at 6, hear The Underground. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, lows 35 to 40. Tomorrow, rain at times with highs around 45. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Multnomah County health officials are recommending that thousands of Portland-area children get new vaccines. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside has more.
The medicines at several clinics were stored at temperatures that were either too warm or too cold. An official for the State Department of Human Services calls it the biggest breakdown in vaccine storage in Oregon's history. The problem involves 25,000 doses of vaccine that were stored at 8 Multnomah County health clinics during the past 3 years. Gary Oxman, Multnomah County health officer, says it will take weeks to determine which children need to be revaccinated. In Beaverton, health inspectors found improper temperatures in a refrigerator storage unit at Beaverton Clinic in 2003 and sent notices recommending revaccination for 3,000 children. That clinic storage problem involved only the combined diphtheria tetanus pertussis shot. Multnomah County's problem covers a long list of diseases. Oxman said the county has started replacing problem refrigerators and has begun, quote, intense training for folks who are responsible for vaccine storage. County health workers are going through the records of thousands of people who were vaccinated, trying to match up names with batches of suspect vaccine. Health workers will start with children whose early vaccinations are in question, along with people who have immune system disorders. The childhood vaccinations in question include those for pneumococcal disease, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, hemophilus influenza type B, hepatitis B, and viral influenza, Oxman said. Despite the problem, Oxman said health officials have not seen an increase in vaccine-preventable diseases. For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside.
The Oregonian reported today that vandals spray-painted anti-gay slurs inside and outside the Sovie Island home of a man whose longtime companion died of AIDS last spring. The newspaper had published a feature story on the couple, Sovie Island residents George Sewell and David Pennington, in May. Pennington had fought HIV and AIDS for 25 years. Sewell, a psychiatrist, had maintained a skilled nursing facility in their home. Sewell called authorities after returning last Wednesday to his home on Northwest Sovie Island Road. Two vehicles and a sedan were parked in the driveway. Spray paint on one of the pickup's side windows, clearly visible to neighbors, referred to the death of Sewell's companion. The vandals, who forced their way into the home, will be subject to burglary, intimidation, and criminal mischief charges. Investigators are trying to determine whether anything was stolen.
A federal appeals court panel today upheld Oregon's voter-passed ban on paying gatherers by the signature on initiative and referendum petitions, saying any minor free speech issues were outweighed by a greater benefit. By a 3-1 margin, voters passed the ban as Measure 26 in the 2002 general election. The challenge was filed by the nonprofit Tigard-based Oregonians in Action. In addition to free speech issues, opponents of the measure argued that it essentially restricted the signature gathering process to labor unions and other large organizations that could afford to pay by the hour or by the day. In February 2004, U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken upheld the measure against those who said it violated free speech provisions of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The ban does not apply to petitions for nominating political candidates. Signature gatherers still can be paid by the hour, for example, but not based on signatures gathered.
The Mexican Consul General for Oregon says the Umatilla County Sheriff sent him a bill to cover the jail costs of illegal Mexican immigrants. Sheriff John Trumbo sent the letter to Mexican President Vicente Fox on February 9th, claiming that Umatilla County had spent $318,843 to house 360 undocumented Mexican immigrants in 2005. Trumbo says he did not expect a reply from Mexico, but Sanchez said he believes Fox will respond. Trumbo told a reporter yesterday, quote, "These people have entered my home and committed crimes, and I don't like it." The Mexican Consul General, Fernando Sanchez, said Trumbo should recognize the contributions that Hispanic communities make to the country. But Trumbo says he worries about, quote, "those who sneak in and end up in jail, and our citizens are the ones who end up having to pay for their medical and dental and housing. Enough is enough." Sanchez said if Trumbo wants funding for jail costs for illegal immigrants, that, quote, "Does he want Mexico to send his police there to take care of crime committed by Mexicans, too?"
Microsoft Corporation says it's donating $1,700,000 in computer software to Portland-based Mercy Corps. The money will help speed up communications in times of disasters. The grant to Mercy Corps is part of $41 million that Microsoft is giving to two groups of aid organizations, NetHope and the Interagency Working Group for both Emergency Capacity Building. Mercy Corps is a member of both. Mercy Corps CEO Neil Kenny Geyer says its response to all the recent disasters underscored the need for increased collaboration among humanitarian groups that respond to emergencies. NetHope members will use donations to aid major systems upgrades. Microsoft officials say it's important to help improve humanitarian efforts through technical resources.
Portland State University's student government elections in March are shaping into a statewide electoral milestone. The university is converting from a traditional electoral system to one based on instant runoff voting, long promoted by Green Party activists pushing for election reform in government. Portland State will be the first public university and the first public institution in Oregon to use this method. It's also known as ranked choice voting. Rather than vote for a single candidate or a group of candidates, voters rank candidates in order of preference. Voters' first choices are tallied. If no candidate receives more than 50% of the vote, the candidate who received the lowest number of votes is eliminated. The votes for that candidate are then redistributed among voters' second choices on the ballot. The process continues until more than 50% of the votes fall under one candidate. Reed and Lewis and Clark Colleges, both private institutions, also use ranked choice voting for student elections.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 22nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and audio editor for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer is Rabia Yeaman. Special thanks to reporters Sheila Whiteside and Richard Francis. Our engineer is Eduardo de Landeros Tierra. The KBOO Evening News Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Kirk Vanderveer.
And I'm Brian
Pritchett. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, join us for the morning news. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher interviews Susan Lynn, author of Consuming Kids. She's in Portland to speak about the effects of commercial marketing on children. At 9:30, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, the guest is Jane Midgley, author of Women and the U.S. Budget, Where the Money Goes and What You Can Do About It. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard's guests are media artist Rose Bond and choreographer Dawn Joella Jackson talking about their new collaboration, Word of Court, County of Origin. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us, and have a great evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 22, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Housing Authority of New Orleans issues new rules. We'll hear from public housing residents. Palestinian solidarity groups are calling for the international community to respect Hamas's victory in recent elections. And we'll take a look at the controversies surrounding the United Arab Emirates managing U.S. ports. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. California prison officials have called off the scheduled execution of convicted murderer and rapist Michael Morales. The move leaves California's execution process in limbo and will lead to the first court hearing in the nation over the constitutionality of execution by lethal injection. Christopher Martinez reports from KPFA.
California's execution of convicted murderer Michael Morales has been called off for the second time in 24 hours after a whirlwind of activity that has included objections from doctors and nurses and questions over whether the lethal injection process is inhumane. Morales was scheduled for execution shortly after midnight Tuesday morning in a process that was to include two court-ordered anesthesiologists. But they withdrew at the 11th hour, saying, "What is being asked of us now is ethically unacceptable." Franklin Zimmering is a law professor at the University of California in Berkeley.
This is California's first adventure with civil disobedience in the execution process.
When the state rescheduled the execution for 7:30 Tuesday evening with new procedures and without the anesthesiologists, a federal judge ordered that the lethal injection be given by a medical professional. But doctors and nurses groups have objected because of medical ethics guidelines that bar them from taking part in executions. The state again called off the execution because it could not find a doctor or nurse willing to act as executioner. Federal District Court Judge Jeremy Fogel has now scheduled a full hearing on the constitutionality of California's executions by lethal injection. That hearing, the first of its kind in the nation, will take place in early May. Until then, executions in California will be on hold. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christopher Martinez.
A bombing attack this morning in Samarra, Iraq, completely destroyed the Gold Dome of one of the holiest sites to Shia Muslims. The partial destruction of the shrine sparked massive protests in cities throughout Iraq. Sectarian violence between Shias and Sunnis that erupted after this morning's explosion has left at least 6 dead. In Nigeria, more than 70 people have been killed and several places of worship have been incinerated in recent sectarian violence between Christians and Muslims. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The violence started on Saturday in the predominantly Muslim north, a protest by Muslim youths against cartoons of Prophet Muhammad in a Danish newspaper, culminated in an attack on Christians. Nigeria's main Christian body, the Christian Association of Nigeria, says 51 Christians were killed while 30 churches were burnt down. News of the attacks was received with anger in the predominantly Christian south. In the southern city of Onitsha, violence broke out when the remains of some of those killed in the north were brought to the town for burial. Christian youths took to the streets to attack northern Muslims. 20 Muslims were killed while 2 mosques were set on fire. Religious conflicts between the north and south have claimed more than 10,000 lives in the last 6 years. As Africa's most populous country and the continent's leading oil exporter, any major crisis in Nigeria is likely to have negative international implications. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Ecuador's president declared a state of emergency last night in the wake of protests that have slowed oil production in the Amazon province of Napo. Protesters continue to occupy a pumping station that supplies the country's most important privately owned pipeline. They are reportedly holding 24 pipeline workers hostage. The protesters are calling for greater investment in infrastructure projects and for a greater share of the oil wealth to benefit the local communities. At airtime, troops were being deployed to the region. A draft treaty between the European Union and the U.S. threatens the ability of European Union states to legislate against the most polluting transport industry in the world, air travel. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The air industry is an effectively subsidized industry. Unlike road or rail operators, airlines are still not required to pay tax on fuel. Just how long that can last may depend on international agreements, which campaigners say are going in entirely the wrong direction. Article 14 of this draft Open Skies Treaty says that any EU country wanting to legislate against noise and air pollution by the aviation industry will first have to reach agreement with each other and with the US. That means signatories will sign away their individual power to impose such things as environmental taxes, restrictions and safeguards on airlines. Any disagreement between nations would be referred to a committee comprising airports, airlines, and governments. The treaty says that signatories must, quote, recognize that the costs and benefits of measures to protect the environment must be carefully weighed. The treaty requires 65% of EU countries to approve it for it to be enacted. However, some EU states want amendments, and they're hoping to negotiate before the vote. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The uproar from both Democratic and Republican officials over a company based in the United Arab Emirates managing U.S. ports continues. The White House is working to calm congressional members by conducting briefings, trying to assure Congress that the program is secure. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Outcries are coming from all levels of government on both sides of the aisle. Republican representative from New York, Vito Fisella, says that the mandated 45-day period of review for foreign ownership should have been implemented. It would have given Congress the opportunity to look into this agreement.
In this case, we seem to be going the other direction, where a private, foreign-based corporation is now going to be run by a company controlled by another country. And I think it's fair to ask the questions.
Members of the House of Representatives are saying that legislation could pass calling off the deal. And in the Senate, members are threatening legislation to ban all foreign companies from having operational authority of U.S. ports. And the White House has begun briefing members of Congress. Scott McClellan, White House Press Secretary.
In hindsight, when you look at this and the coverage that it's received and the false impression that it's left with some, we probably should have briefed members of Congress about it sooner.
The president also recently learned of the deal. He was told days after it was approved. The controversy arose because a British company was sold to Dubai World Ports, a company whose owners are from the United Arab Emirates, a country that could have an indirect connection to the September 11th hijackings. The company will manage some cargo terminals at six ports in the eastern United States. The United States also has an interest in the country. The White House says that the United Arab Emirates has cooperated with the administration on the war on terror. Again, Scott McClellan.
They provide access to their ports for our aircraft carriers. They provide access to our Air Force planes over their airspace and at their airports. The UAE is someone we have worked very closely with to crack down on terrorist financing.
And the country, which is partially democratic, is one of the top 10 oil producers in the world and ranks third in oil reserves. Furthermore, David Sanborn, who was appointed by President Bush to be Maritime Administrator of the Transportation Department, is a former executive at Dubai World Ports. But the administration dismissed this connection as any reason for okaying the deal. The Bush administration maintains that the review of the deal was thorough and that no member of the administration objected. The president also maintains that he will veto any legislation attempting to disrupt the agreement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Local, state, and federal lawmakers from both parties are saying that the Bush administration may be placing the country at risk by allowing the transfer of ports to a company based in the United Arab Emirates that up until now are managed by a British company. But some critics say that lawmakers are using the controversy to make Arabs synonymous with terrorism. We're joined on the line by Rabia Ahmed, spokesperson with the Council on American Islamic Relations. Why do you think that politicians are reacting in this way now?
Well, it is a political year, so I think that it's a good topic that they can play political football with. Everybody is concerned with national security on both sides of the debate, but I think it's something that's been easily used to feed into the fears and the stereotypes that many Americans have about the Arab world.
The Bush administration seems to be standing by its decision. How do you think this will work out through Congress?
I see this continuing to be in the news cycle for the next few days until Congress is in session and has called for legislation calling for a investigation into the matter. I don't know how it's going to play out because of the fact that it has such widespread opposition to this business transaction. It will be interesting to see if President Bush stands by his position or if people in Congress are successful in getting this deal halted.
And this controversy is hitting the U.S. even as the Prophet Muhammad cartoon controversy is hitting not necessarily the Arab world, but the Muslim world in particular. What do you see in the future for Arab and Muslim international relations?
Well, both of these instances have done really nothing to promote a better understanding of each other. I think that they have been very harmful in building better relationships between the Muslim world and the West, because they haven't been dealt properly by our leaders. By saying that Americans are concerned with the security of our borders if it's being conducted by an Arab-based company, and simply because of the fact that it's an Arab company, I think that sends a very dangerous message, not only to our citizens in this country, but to the worldwide community, that Arabs are just not to be trusted simply based on the fact that they're Arab.
Rabia Ahmed is the spokesperson for the Council on American Islamic Relations. She joined us today from Washington. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can hear the newscast online by logging on to www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Sri Lanka marks the fourth anniversary of its ceasefire with peace talks mediated by Switzerland and Norway. The truce has paved the way for a recovery in Sri Lanka's $20 billion economy, which has expanded in every subsequent quarter.
The country's progress toward a peace settlement is a condition set by donor countries, including the U.S. and Norway, for providing $4.5 billion in aid. Paniya Manikavasagam has more.
The Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tiger rebels have begun 2 days of peace talks in Geneva to strengthen the ceasefire agreement signed 4 years ago. For the past 3 years, the Norway brokered peace process was stalled due to a demand by the rebels for full autonomy in the northeastern region of the island nation. According to political observers, these talks will be crucial in deciding whether the tiny island in the Indian Ocean will slip back into war. Paramuthamil Selvan is the political leader of the Tamil Tigers. He told reporters political issues will not be discussed in Geneva before boarding a government helicopter in the rebel-held northern town of Kilinochi.
Tamil people and the leadership of the Tamil people, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Elam, expect from Geneva a resolution of the question of serious, effective implementation of the ceasefire agreement. We reiterate the issue because the ceasefire agreement is the bedrock of the entire peace process.
However, officials involved in the peace process say that government negotiators are likely to push for amendments to the truce, which the rebels have already rejected. On Tuesday, civil organizations in the northern districts observed the day with prayers for peace.
The situation is bad. Forces are deployed everywhere. The situation should improve with the talks.
Across the country, many hope these talks will stop the wave of violence that have reignited fears of a new war. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
The Housing Authority of New Orleans put forth new rules this week defining who can return to the city's housing developments. 6 months after Hurricane Katrina, only a small number of housing development residents have been allowed back, and critics say the Housing Authority isn't working hard enough to bring back the people who it served. FSRN's Christian Roseland is in New Orleans and spoke with public housing residents.
You know, all the thing I'm asking, why spend, I don't know how much... This is coming out of my $300,000 to put a fence around this development instead of taking that same $300,000 and put some people or your people to work and work on it.
Stephanie Mingo stood outside the metal structure of a chain link fence surrounding the sprawling St. Bernard housing development in New Orleans, looking for answers from the Housing Authority officials who had come to speak. Like many of the 49,000 individuals that the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO, served before the storm, Mingo says that she wants to come home.
At least fix one side. Mm-hmm. At least fix one side of the development and let so many people move in. I'm stressed. I'm falling out. I'm going through a lot of different stuff. I've been back here 43 long years. All I'm just asking, begging, and pleading is to come home.
Okay.
And that's it. But I'm really, really, and truly... want my people to come home. And I'm not only speaking about this development, no. Yeah. I'm speaking about all development.
It's been 6 months since Hurricane Katrina hit, and other than the fence, little work, if any, has been done to the St. Bernard development, which still has torn roofs, broken windows, doors falling off their hinges, and debris scattered about. Hanno admits that work has gone slowly on all 10 housing developments, and according to Adonis Exposé of Hanno, only 695 families have been allowed to return to three of the developments which did not flood. Hanno's executive director, Nadine Jarmon.
It is what it is. It took in 4 to 6 feet of water. You see the water line. We're not making stuff up to be convenient so that we can hopefully dig into this conspiracy theory to keep people out. That's not what we're doing.
However, Jarmon is not saying when, if ever, the development will be reopened. In some cases, such as the Iberville complex, large metal plates have been fitted over doors and windows, which Hanno says is to prevent theft, but many residents say is to keep them from coming back. On Monday, Hanno officials announced a set of new requirements for those returning to the city's housing developments, including assessments of personal employment history and work prospects, a decision that was applauded by New Orleans City Council members. Oliver Thomas, who holds one of the council at large seats, said that the city had done enough pampering of residents. However, 2000 census data shows that most housing developments had only slightly lower employment levels than the city average, and many who are trying to return suspect that they are simply no longer welcome in the city. Sam Jackson, a former resident of the B.W. Cooper development who is now living in a trailer.
What about the poor people? What about the people that got out there and got in trouble?
You understand what I'm saying? And coming back here, and they never had nothing up and running for this schooling or GED or some type of community activity for the kids them to get involved into. He never looked at it that way. Only thing is they got, it was a good reason to get the people out the project when the water come into us.
The situation for those trying to return is made worse by a shortage of FEMA trailers, which many who have applied for have not yet received. Public housing advocates say the city has other plans for the land that the housing developments are on. In late October, Alphonse Jackson of HUD said that River Gardens, a project which replaced the St. Thomas development with mostly market-rate housing and a super Walmart, would be the model for the future of public housing in New Orleans. And Home Depot recently signed a 364-day lease to put a tent store on the site of the now-vacant C.J. Peet housing complex. Mingo, like many, is currently on a waiting list to get into an available unit in another development. Hanno has not announced what is to happen to those who do not qualify to return and where they will live, and did not respond to a request for an interview by FSRN. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Christian Roseland.
The Palestinian Solidarity Movement is concerned at the growing number of calls by U.S. Congress members and their European allies to suspend financial aid to Palestine. Groups are now calling for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestine and for the international community to respect the democratic process which led to Hamas's recent victory in the Palestinian Legislative Council. D.C. Radio Co-op's Reem Kakuda has more from Washington, D.C.
It's a question of Israeli oppression, discriminatory policies towards the Palestinians, and those remain regardless of what the governing body in Palestine is.
Bayan Hamid of Georgetown University is one of hundreds organizing a nationwide effort to divest from Israel, which is using the victory of Hamas, Palestine's Islamic, quote, Reform and Change Party, in a recent competitive multi-party democratic election.
All of our schools are going to launch actions on our campuses on March 30th, which is Palestinian Land Day, to raise awareness about the issue.
And while the Palestinians face economic strangulation, with Israel stopping vital Palestinian tax revenue payments, and Western donors supporting Israel and threatening to cut U.S. and UN aid, the Palestine Solidarity Movement is reiterating its call for international justice.
Out of any time in the history of the Palestinian plight, this is perhaps the most important time to have an international boycott and divestment movement.
Hamad Abed, a member of the University of Wisconsin Divest from Israel campaign.
The international community is not carrying through with its obligations towards the Palestinian people. In fact, it's frustrating their right to self-determination being threatened with sanctions and economic pressure, and yet the root source of the problem, which is the apartheid system that Israel has imposed in historical Palestine, is not being addressed.
Abed is one of hundreds at the 5th Annual National Student Conference of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, who gathered recently at Georgetown University. Many members of the United States Congress are pushing a suspension of U.S. aid to the Palestinians, with more than four bills in both houses. Concurrent Resolution 79 passed with 418 to one vote, with Congressman Neil Abercrombie of Hawaii dissenting. Resolution H.R. 4668, the limitation of assistance to the Palestinian Authority, has 20 sponsors. S-2237, the Palestinian Compliance Act of 2006, has 3 sponsors, while H.R. 4681, with 69 sponsors, both Democrats and Republicans, proposing a U.S. policy which would limit both U.S. and UN aid to the Palestinians unless their legislative council recognizes Israel and, quote, eliminates anti-Israel incitements, among other conditions, is the most crucial bill awaiting a vote. Groups such as the Citizens for Fair Legislation, CFL, and the American Anti-Discrimination Committee are urging people to voice concerns with such extraterritorial interference measures, says Sheehan Fair of CFL.
We oppose Resolution H.R. 4681 called the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act of 2006. We think that this resolution would be devastating to innocent civilians, especially children who would be affected, because it would mean a cut in food programs and education. So we hope that American citizens and citizens of conscience everywhere would take a moment to contact their elected officials and oppose Resolution H.R. 4681.
The Center for National Interest, a nonpartisan grassroots organization made of many former U.S. government officials, advocating for a new direction for U.S. Middle Eastern policy, participated as international observers to the recent Palestinian elections. Eugene Bird is a member of the delegation who met with government and opposition figures in six Arab countries.
It's time for us to recognize Islamic nationalism throughout the Arab world because they have won legitimate elections. They want to communicate, they want a dialogue, they want to negotiate with the United States and with Europe. The peace process that they're looking for is, first of all, a continuation of the ceasefire long term. They want a credible partner on the other side for peace.
Meanwhile, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation has enlisted the signature of more than 165 organizations to end Israel's 37-year occupation of the Palestinian Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Amrim Katkhodadisi, RadioCoop.org.
The idea that farmers could produce the fuel we use to drive our cars and heat our homes, effectively putting oil barons out of business, has been germinating since the 1970s energy crisis. Three decades later, an ongoing war in Iraq, disasters from global warming, and $3 a gallon gasoline prices may see homegrown biodiesel production finally take root. Following Minnesota's lead, Washington State is advancing alternative energy bills that would provide loans for growing biodiesel crops and mandate biodiesel and ethanol fuel standards. Martha Baskin has the story.
As a nation, we have 3% of the world's petroleum in our borders. So that means for 97% of the petroleum we use, we rely on others to bring that to us. Maybe friends, maybe allies, maybe enemies. Do we really, as a country, want to stand by and accept that as the status quo?
Seattle Biodiesel's John Plaza isn't waiting for the answer. He's too busy working on an alternative to big oil. For the last year, the company the commercial airline pilot founded to reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil and provide a cleaner environment has been converting soybean oil from the Midwest to biodiesel. Orders are soaring. The Department of Navy and all non-combat vehicles use biodiesel blends of 20%, as does the city of Seattle, the port of Seattle, county buses, the school district, and a multitude of smaller fleets from rug cleaning companies to bakeries. Biodiesel has reached critical mass. Governor Christine Gregoire, state lawmakers, environmentalists, farmers, and entrepreneurs talk about how the liquid gold can not only bridge the politically hot red-blue divide, but provide an immediate solution to global climate destruction caused by fossil fuels. Today, several alternative energy bills are circulating in the state legislature with bipartisan support. One bill, which the House has approved, would fund four crushing plants where canola and mustard seed, two other viable biodiesel seeds, could be harvested regionally. A second bill would require petroleum vendors in the state to sell at least 2% biodiesel or ethanol out of their total sales. It would take effect in 2008 and over time grow to 5% for biodiesel and 10% for ethanol. The prime sponsor of the bill, Republican Janaea Holmquist, says farmers were the catalyst for the bill, followed by the governor. Holmquist says renewable fuel standards will act as an incentive to the oil industry to provide Washington producers and manufacturers market access.
So what this measure and why it's so important is that it doesn't only just assure a minimum market, it assures that they will actually have market access.
Meaning that there'll be plants here and facilities here in Washington?
Bingo. Well, and not only that, even if we were to have plants, which we currently have Seattle Biodiesel right there in the heart of Seattle, it will ensure that they can actually get the product out to the consumers around all of Washington.
K.C. Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions, has been working with both the legislature and entrepreneurs like John Plaza and Seattle Biodiesel. He says the country's addiction to fossil fuels is whacking us over the head in at least three increasingly obvious ways. One is national security. The second is economic, both the drain on individual wallets and the enormous drain on the country's economic resources. And the third is global climate disruption. He says all three are urgent priorities.
When we go out there and talk to people about this, we see a really strong social consensus on that point, quite across political spectrums or political viewpoints or party affiliation or geography. Nobody wants to just sit around and wait to get whacked one more time by the cost of our fossil fuel dependence. Everybody's hungry for an alternative.
The neat thing about biodiesel fuel policy, says Golden, is that it really costs government next to nothing, but is a powerful public policy.
Because what it says is we will build a stable, growing market for our biofuel industries in the state. And that's the kind of commitment that farmers and entrepreneurs can take to the bank and really build a business on.
Seattle Biodiesel anticipates breaking ground on a larger production facility this year. They also plan to develop a crushing facility. Word on the plant floor is that billionaire Paul Allen plans to chip in. In addition, they have plans for international facilities. In spite of bipartisan and public support, however, it remains to be seen whether state legislators will stand up to inevitable oil industry pressure and send the pending legislation for renewable fuel standards to the governor for signature. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. For an archive of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
KBOO has an immediate opening available for a 10-hour per week part-time office assistant. The position is available to Portland Community College students who have federal work-study award and skills in office administration. To apply for this position, please email your resume with a brief letter of interest to membership@kboo.org. If you would like more information about the position, email or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. The position will remain open until filled.
Portland Community College would like to invite you to the 16th Annual African Film Festival honoring Black History Month at PCC's Cascade Campus. This year's festival will feature 28 political, historical, and socially charged films as seen through the eyes of Africans. The films will cover a wide range of themes and topics, from the African legacy in Mexico, women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence, to love across class lines and preservation of African cultural and artistic heritage. This KBOO co-sponsored festival will be free of charge and will cover a five-week period from February 3rd through March 4th. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.